Welcome to Whiskey Cask, Cask Strength Conversation, featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 431 for June 29th, 2013. Coming up in a few minutes.
I thought it was a little rude when I would travel abroad and I would see all of these amazing whiskeys that I knew we weren't going to get in this state. It's not rude, but, you know, there was definitely a jealousy factor. So I said, if I am able to do this, I would like to bring it to the state first.
Earlier this month, we discussed the history of women in the whiskey business. This week, we'll look at the future with two women seeking to change the way we look at whiskey. Alison Patel found a French cognac distiller who was making single malt whiskey on the side for himself and his friends and turned it into the Bren Whiskey brand. Karen Luna Ostaseski built her new Sia blended scotch brand from scratch with the help of whiskey lovers on Kickstarter, and it'll debut soon in San Francisco. We'll hear more from Allison and Karen later on Whiskey Cast In Depth. I'll also have the calendar of events, your voice, and the What I'm Tasting This Week department, all on this week's Whiskey Cast.
Whiskey Cast. Proudly brought to you by Redbreast. The definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Join the Stillhouse at singlepotstill.com and receive an exclusive Whiskey Tasting Journal.
Let's start off with the week's news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie. Another big investment in Kentucky bourbon this week. Brown-Forman plans to spend $35 million to increase production at Woodford Reserve. The project will get underway this fall and includes three new maturation warehouses that will hold 165,000 casks, three additional stills, and upgrades on the bottling line, along with other innovations. It'll be the first major expansion at the distillery since it reopened in 1996, following a major restoration of the old LeBrow and Graham distillery. Last week I mentioned the flooding in southern Alberta, and while the waters are receding in many places, one whiskey distillery is facing an uncertain future. Highwood Distillers is located in High River, Alberta, where the Highwood River flood has claimed at least three lives. I've been keeping in touch with Highwood Operations Manager Jared Grant, and the distillery has been closed since power went out on June 20th as the entire town was flooded. As of Friday, there are still mandatory evacuation orders in place for the entire town of High River. Jared has not been allowed to check on the distillery to see what's been damaged. The distillery is located on one of the higher pieces of land in High River, but all of its maturing whiskey stocks are stored in warehouses at the site as well. I'll keep you posted as more details are available. In other news, we got word on new whiskeys this week. Talisker's Dark Storm will be released in the travel retail market, and it's said to be the smokiest Talisker ever. Glenfiddich is releasing a new Cask of Dreams expression for the Scandinavian market. This one was finished off in Nordic oak, and it'll be available primarily through the Viking Line cruise ships, with limited availability at land-based retailers in the area. The McAllen is releasing a new Lalique Decanter Edition. M is a no-age statement sherry cask matured single malt that comes in a Lalique Decanter, created by noted designer Fabian Baron. Only 1,750 numbered decanters will be available worldwide. The suggested retail price is $4,500 each. And there's another entry in the flavored whiskey market from Jim Beam. Technically, there are two, but I'll explain that in a minute. Knob Creek Smoked Maple is regular 9-year-old Knob Creek bourbon with added maple and smoke flavors. Now, it's been common to say for years that you can't add flavorings to a bourbon and still use the word bourbon on the label. It turns out that is not completely the case. Beam's Fred Noe explained to me how his father, the legendary Booker Noe, helped set the stage for this years ago.
Well, we took, you know, the basic Knob Creek bourbon, and then we infused it, you know, with the maple and, you know, some, and the smoke to give it a flavor, you know, kind of something a little different. Like, see, Dad used to play around. He actually got some tree caps when he was in Vermont on vacation years ago and tapped a couple of sugar maple trees in our yard and made some maple syrup out of the sap that he got out of the trees. And, you know, we cured country hams and did sausage and smoked that in the backyard during the meat house. Still do that. But that kind of gave us the idea on, you know, some of the stuff that Dad did. And then we played with some flavors and thought it might be kind of cool for, you know, maybe an after-dinner drink. So that's kind of where the idea come from stuff that my dad did, you know, in the backyard, and then played with the flavors and got it where we got pretty good balance on it, where it tastes good, and thought we would, you know, expand the Knob Creek line a little bit.
Now, I need to ask you, this is causing some controversy because we've been told for years and years that you can't call a whiskey a bourbon if it has stuff added to it. And this has got Kentucky Straight Bourbon Whiskey all over the label on the front with added flavors, with natural flavors added onto it on that line. But how can you call it a bourbon? And I'm playing devil's advocate here, but tell me how you can call this, how you can even use the word bourbon on the label if it's got flavors in it.
Well, we followed all of the laws regarding bourbon making the Knob Creek. And we took the Knob Creek and did the infusion with it. I mean, we don't call it maple bourbon. You know, we call it Kentucky Straight Bourbon Whiskey that has been infused with. And that is the way it is. I mean, you're starting with the base spirit of bourbon itself. You're not, you know, we don't put the maple in it when it comes off the still, or we don't put the maple in the barrel. You know, this is after it's gone through all of the requirements to be a bourbon, then we do the work to it on the back end. I mean, it's like we're not adding any caramel coloring to get the color. It gets 100% of the color from the barrel, just like all the other bourbons we produce. Everything is still 51% corn. It's still made in the United States. It's aged in a new barrel. Distilled at less than 160 proof, barreled at 125 or less, bottled at greater than 80, and, you know, which aged more than 2 years in Kentucky, so you can call it Kentucky Straight Bourbon Whiskey. That is the base. And then from there, we take that. And that's why on the label, if you look, the font is exactly the same. There's no emphasis put on the maple and the smoke. It's in the same font as Kentucky Straight Bourbon Whiskey. You know, it's not a, you know, that's the whole deal. It's just like with the Red Stag. You know, we took Jim Beam, 4-year-old Jim Beam, Kentucky Straight Bourbon Whiskey, and infused it. So you're taking bourbon and infusing it. I mean, we did years ago, my dad did Distiller's Masterpiece, which was, the first version was an 18-year-old bourbon that was finished in Kodak casks. But it was right on the label. It said Kentucky Straight Bourbon Whiskey finished in cognac casks. 2 years later, we did a 20-year-old version of Distiller's Masterpiece that we finished in port wine barrels from a winery in California. So, I mean, we've been doing it for a long time. So it's not, but, you know, we're not putting it, calling it a maple bourbon. It's bourbon that has been infused with the flavors. That's kind of the how it gets approved and how the process has been approved by TTB.
So essentially, it's a bourbon whiskey with the maple flavors and the smoke flavors added into it.
Correct.
And that's how you work, and by the labeling is essentially the workaround to get around to that rule about you can't put flavors into a bourbon whiskey. This is how you work around that, right?
Yeah, you start off with bourbon and then add the infusion to it. Everything, all the rules of bourbon are followed with the base spirit, and then we take the bourbon and infuse it with the flavors.
And where you'd run into trouble is if you put the stuff in at the start of the process.
Yeah,
or
now if you were to say you were to put the maple in the barrel at the time you fill the barrel, and it stays in there during the aging, then you wouldn't be able to call it a bourbon at that point.
Now, you're getting ready to do something similar with Jim Beam, right, with the Jim Beam Honey.
Right.
When's that coming
out? It's a little different deal now. It's going to be a little bit lower proof, I think, of the honey.
So that makes it a liqueur, technically, if it's below 40%, right?
If you take the proof below 80, you can't call it a bourbon. It would be a liqueur.
And when will that be out?
I haven't seen the exact date on that one. It's getting out in some markets right now. It's starting to, in some of the control states, to get it lifted. It's already been released in some states.
And, of course, Jim Beam Honey is the second entry I was referring to. But remember, if it's below 40% ABV, it can't be called a whiskey, Instead, it's a liqueur. And technically, Knob Creek smoked maple is not officially a bourbon, as far as the U.S. government is concerned. There's a separate category at the TTB, the Tax and Trade Bureau, for so-called whiskey specialty products, and it's essentially a wild card category. That's what flavored and finished bourbons get slotted into, along with single malts from countries other than Scotland and Ireland, and anything else that doesn't quite fit into the strict whiskey definitions the TTB has used for many years. Now, this is something that distilleries pay lawyers a lot of money to figure out. You're learning it for free here on WhiskeyCast. You can keep up with the latest whiskey news all week long at WhiskeyCast.com.
The news is brought to you by Glenmorangie. Help us select the next Glenmorangie single malt whiskey with the Glenmorangie Caskmasters project. Sign up online through the Glenmorangie Facebook page or on glenmorangie.com.
Time now for this week's Your Voice segment, brought to you by Johnny Walker. Slate.com had a pretty good piece this week comparing craft whiskeys with the big boys and girls of the industry. I've posted a link to it at the WhiskeyCast Facebook page. The headline is, quote, Jim Beam and Wild Turkey are better than most craft whiskeys, end quote. Bernard Schaefer in Germany posted this comment. Of course they are. Most of the craft whiskey I had the pleasure to taste are funny for science, but not for pleasure. I had a commentary on this subject recently in Whiskey Magazine, and one of the things the editors cut out was a quote from the late science fiction writer Theodore Sturgeon. His classic line, 90% of everything is crap. There are some very good craft distillers out there, but there are others who probably shouldn't be giving up their day jobs quite yet. Of course, the same could be said for almost any endeavor. If you have something you'd like to share with whiskey lovers around the world, you can always post it on the Your Voice page at WhiskeyCast.com, or just email me. My address is comments@WhiskeyCast.com. This week's Your Voice segment is brought to you by Johnny Walker on the web at JohnnyWalker.com. Time now for the calendar of events, brought to you as always by Laphroaig. The Whiskey Lounge is sponsoring a series of Glenmorangie Caskmasters tastings around the UK in July, starting this week in London and Brighton. There's a complete schedule on the calendar at WhiskeyCast.com. This week's Wednesday night tasting at the Commercial Hall in Dufton, Scotland, in the heart of Speyside, will feature Adelphi's range of whiskies. And despite the recent flooding in Calgary, the whiskey tastings will go on. Willow Park Wines and Spirits will hold its All-American Beer and Whiskey Festival July 4th. And the Kensington Wine Market will host the Scotch Malt Whiskey Society's Canadian Chapter First Friday tasting on the 5th. The Canadian Chapter will also have a tasting on the 8th at Edgemont Fine Wines in Vancouver. The Brandy Library in New York City will have a Scotch Spirit School on July 9th, and the Distilled Spirits Epicenter in Louisville has a Bourbon and Cooking class July 13th. Those are just a few of the more than 250 different whiskey events around the world on the calendar of events at WhiskeyCast.com. It's brought to you by Laphroaig. Take a virtual distillery tour at Laphroaig.com, and while you're there, become a friend of Laphroaig and claim your own square foot of Isla.
WhiskeyCast, brought to you by Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. In conversation with Anton Sweeney, spirit store foreman, Redbreast single pot still Irish whiskey.
What I like about Redbreast is so smooth, mellow, and just after one or two, you just kind of go into a state of a tranquility. I suppose you could say Most breasts need a bit of a lift, but this breast gives you one hell of a lift.
Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Those in the know Redbreast.
WhiskeyCast In Depth is brought to you by Woodford Reserve. Earlier this month, Fred Minnick told us about his upcoming book on the history of women in the whiskey business. Of course, women are making whiskey history as we speak, managing distilleries, serving as master blenders, and a few entrepreneurs are even creating their own whiskey brands. One is about to make its debut in San Francisco, where Karen Luna Ostaseski has been developing Sia. It's a blended scotch that fulfills her desire to create something different.
The name Sia, it's pronounced Sia in Gaelic, means the number six. And when I was looking for a name, I knew that I wanted the scotch to have the alliteration of S scotch. So I went through Scottish baby book names or baby names, and then also started going through the Scottish Gaelic dictionary and the S section, and just kind of went through each one and felt it out. And then when I came across Sia, I thought it was perfect because it's easy to pronounce. It's easy to read from afar. I'm turning 36, so one of the hard things for me is when I sit at a bar and the name of a bottle on a shelf and I find myself squinting a little bit. So it was important to me to have the name be something that's really easy to read from afar and also easy to say.
So why did you decide to create your own scotch after working in the hospitality industry for a number of years?
So I'm actually not from the hospitality industry. I come from a background in creative direction. So I've been making virtual products for computers and mobile devices, logos and animations for about 16 years now. And what was frustrating through that process is I spent so much time staring at a computer screen so that other people could stare at their computer screens. And I realized that I wanted to make something that connected people in person. And my passion for scotch has been about a 10-year love affair. I knew it was a perfect mix. So I started doing scotch tasting events in San Francisco about 2 years ago to kind of find out what it was that people really liked, what flavors resonated, especially to novice scotch drinkers, because my passion has been introducing people to scotch whiskey rather than trying to convert scotch whiskey lovers from one brand to another. So I started the process there and quickly found that that's exactly what I wanted to be doing.
And I referred to the hospitality industry because you also have a bartender's license, which is unusual for most creative directors and people in the computer industry, although probably isn't as unusual as it should be, I think.
No, well, the bartending license is actually so that I can come to understand from both sides of the industry, what is it like to serve someone from the bar? What are they looking for? What's the proper way to serve a cocktail? So it was more for personal education.
So what did you learn?
I learned, the correct way to pour a bottle to avoid spillage, the proper way to handle many people at the bar at the same time, etiquette in terms of how you ask the customer for what they want, how to repeat the order back to them to make sure that you said the right thing, and even funnier things, they taught you, how to walk with a tray of many cocktails at the same time and how to take them off in the appropriate way so they don't all spill on someone. All in all, it was a really fun class to take. It was 2 weeks, about 40 hours in total for your professional certification.
And what did you learn from the tastings that you conducted that helped you create Sia?
Sure. From the tastings, I started doing scotch tastings, and what I learned was I build them as, come to scotch tasting, a flight from different sections, and I found that the people that were coming to the tastings were people that already drank scotch. And I learned that that wasn't the audience that I wanted, and how do I attract people that don't drink scotch to these tastings? So I started pairing the whiskey tastings to other events. So some of them, for example, were jewelry and fashion trunk shows, public speaking engagement, workshops, fundraisers, charity events. So when people discovered, oh, there's a whiskey tasting going on here, and they thought, well, I don't drink scotch, maybe I should try it. And the surprise and the delight on their faces of like, wow, this is actually really good. And having them explain to me what they liked and what they didn't like, so I started taking different existing brands and doing this again and again and covering the bottles, with colored paper so that people weren't skewed by their knowledge of a certain brand. And then at a certain point, started mixing the ones that people started liking more and more in different ratios and proportions. And then I took the one that kept coming out as the winner and sent that off to my importer and distiller and said, let's try to recreate something like this.
And you worked with Douglas Lang and Company in Scotland to actually create the blend, right?
That's correct. They've been amazing partners. And my importer as well, Spirit Imports out of Sunrise, Florida.
And those are the folks who are also behind the Scotch Malt Whiskey Society in the U.S.
Exactly.
as well, so to give them proper credit.
Yes, they run the Scotch Malt Whiskey Association, all the extravaganza events.
So tell me how Kickstarter comes into this, because you actually raised the funding for the initial batch through Kickstarter, right?
Yes. Well, I've put in quite a lot more than that for my own personal savings through the process, but Kickstarter was really what drove it all home in the end to make it a reality. The biggest joy from the Kickstarter experience was just putting it out there and seeing how well it was received by people that I knew, that knew what I was up to for so many years, but also from complete strangers who were so excited about the brand. And, you know, people from all over the world writing to ask, you know, can I get a bottle or how do they order one? So that was a really great experience to know that everything about Sia was sort of a by the people for the people experience, from coming up with a blend by almost crowdsourcing that, and then also to help come up with some of the funds for it as well.
So where is it available? How can people try it?
So right now, the first batch is about 800 bottles, and it has cleared the U.S. Customs, but I'm just waiting on a U.S. distributor for California, which is where I want to launch. I'm in the final paperwork stages of that. So my hope is that early August, it'll be available. And right now, I'm just collecting people's sign-up information from csscotch.com.
And what do you hope to go after that, after California?
So after California, I think what I might do is move my way through the West Coast and pick out some of the more like larger cities, Chicago, New York, Miami, D.C., and then also at the same time start in some of interest in U.K. There's interest in South Africa. I've gotten some interest for Germany. So there's been a lot of interest worldwide. But right now what I'm trying to focus is just launching in California.
And then worry about global domination later, right?
One thing at a time, right?
I'll have my tasting notes for Sia in a few minutes. I first met Allison Patel a couple of years ago in Kentucky when she was working with Chip Tate of Balcones to help him promote his whiskeys. Turns out she had something else in the works back then, too. A French single malt she had discovered and was working to bring to market in the U.S. Bren went on sale last fall in New York City.
I had started working on Bren years ago, and then I had kind of gotten to a point where I realized I needed to quit my job and really gear up and get everything going in, you know, in full-time mode, just to be able to. It took me about 2 years to get all the logistics worked out to bring Bren in. And while I was doing all of that, then I decided to start working with some of these other brands like Balcones and a few others. So I was working on Bren all at the same time, but I just wasn't talking about it or really out there promoting Bren. So it was kind of, it was a little bit more helpful for me to be able to, you know, while Bren was aging and while I was working on all the logistics stuff, to be able to go out there and talk about some other brands that I was still really passionate about.
So how did you discover Bren in the first place? It's a chateau in France that primarily makes cognac, but how did you wind up discovering their whiskey?
You know, I get asked this question all the time, and I wish I remembered. It was definitely one of those moments in my life that I didn't realize how life-changing it was going to be when it was happening. And I can't remember who had tipped me off first, but I set up Local Infusions, which is my import-export company, with the intention of importing whiskeys from non-traditional countries. And before I had really set it up, I was out there exploring some of these world whiskey distilleries, since that's really where my passions are. And I was trying to figure out, you know, if this was possible, what I would build my import portfolio with which brands. And I was looking for, you know, for me, it's not enough to just be a whiskey made in another country. I think that there's a huge opportunity in whiskey to be able to talk about these whiskeys made in other countries in the sense of terroir. So what happens if we start to infuse techniques and or, you know, indigenous species of woods in the barrels and things like that to create kind of, you know, these their own styles of whiskey. So I was out there and I was traveling and I was meeting a lot of people, and someone somewhere said, hey, go check out what my buddy's doing. You know, third generation cognac producer. He just started playing around with the barley that they've been growing and he's got some stuff in barrels. And like I said, I actually still can't remember who told me that, but I jumped on a plane, went to cognac
And at that point in time, Bren, which there was never any intention of it ever coming to market, this gentleman was just really playing around and kind of making whiskey for himself and for his friends. And it was about 3 to 4 years old in the barrel. It started in New French Oak at that point in time. So I thought it was pretty special. I was hopeful that I would be able to get in there, help do some of the wood management, develop it farther, and then be able to bring that out into the world. And lucky for me, it happened that way. So,
what can you tell us about this chateau? Because that's sort of been a mystery surrounding Bren, is the chateau itself and who makes the whiskey and how it's made and all that.
Yeah, it's not a mystery for trying to be a big secret marketing something. But in cognac, you have just like in the grower champagne, you have a lot of tiny little producers. There's farm wineries for champagne, and for cognac, it's farm distilleries, and they grow the grapes, they distill them, they age them, and then they sell them off to the big boys. And so this chateau that I'm working with is one of those. So since the 1920s, since they set up their cognac distillery, there hasn't even been a name on the door. it's just this family, just a couple of people. They've always made their cognac. They grow their own grapes, and then they've always sold their cognac to some of the bigger houses. So they've never released anything under their own label. And that's just it. I mean, like I said, there's no name on the distillery. People ask me all the time if they can go visit, and I joke that there's not even a, you can't even Google map it.
So tell me how the process went for getting a French single malt whiskey into the U.S., because we know that whiskey from non-traditional countries has often had problems getting into the U.S. and meeting all the regulatory standards to be called a single malt.
It was a bit of a challenge. Of course it was. Like you said, a lot of these world single malts are having problems. And, I'm still happy. I guess it's a word that it was approved. And for me, it really went back and forth in the formula part of the approval process. For them, just to make sure that this was a whiskey. But I have to say, as you've alluded to, our country, the laws here are a little bit difficult because single malt is not taken out of the Scotch umbrella. So to be a single malt that's not made in Scotland was a bit of a challenge. I don't know exactly how mine got through, but one of the strange rules for my label in particular was I actually had to write on the label, French single malt whiskey finished in cognac barrels or aged in cognac barrels. I can kind of choose my own language as to the style of production, but they actually wanted that whole sentence in one sentence in one long row. And I said to them, that's a bit long and that'll wrap all the way around the bottle, so that wouldn't necessarily be possible. So they told me I could do one sentence break, but that whole phrase, French single malt whiskey finished in cognac barrels, had to be the same size of font, the same style of font, because in my original label submission, I had done French single malt whiskey in a bigger font, and then I had kind of done underneath finished in cognac barrels. But that was, I guess, a problem for them, that they, if I was calling it French single malt, they also wanted this whole finished in cognac barrels to be in the same font size, which is just...
So your whiskey went on sale last year in New York City.
Correct.
How's it been received so far, and how far have you been able to spread it?
Fantastic. I feel very lucky. I feel very blessed. People have been extremely supportive, and I personally thought it was going to be a little bit more difficult to open people's minds up to the concept of the fact that the French can make whiskey. And there's definitely, some hesitation there with a lot of consumers, but once they seem to try it, once they understand what it is I'm trying to do, I've been received very well. So October 1st, I launched
I was exclusive in New York City for 6 months. And then in April, I launched in Chicago, Boston, and Nashville, Tennessee. And for Bren, a steak cast is my first expression. One of the many unique things that we're doing with this is it's all a steak-grown barley. So we can only produce once a year after we harvest the barley, send it off site for malting, but bring it back and then so on and so forth. So since we can only make this once a year, after distillation and aging, we only have about 2,500 cases if you're doing 9-liter case counts per year for the world. So that's pretty small. So I would like to roll out to more places, but I'm trying to kind of get a feel, since it's selling a little bit faster than I had perhaps anticipated, which is great. but I'm just trying to get a feel for the sales flow, how people are receiving this, and trying to get it to as many people as possible.
How is the distillery going to be able to supply you long term if the guy was making it primarily for himself and his friends at first? Does he have enough stock to actually continue supplying you for the long term?
Sure. Yeah. Like I said, I mean, we're distilling every year 100% of the barley that they're growing in Cognac, France, at the distillery. So when I got there, like I said, most of the barrels were about three, some barrels at 4 years old, and then 2 years, 1 year, and down. But every time he's actually made, I think in the beginning he was playing around a lot more. There were some other barrels there that were a bit older, and I wasn't so interested in them. I think they were a little bit more experimental. But for me, I think he really started getting consistency when I had met him in the barrels that I had found that were about 3 and 4 years down, and so on and so forth. So that said, we work really closely together, and we're pretty, we now have, I bottled in September last year. It was a seven-year-old cask. So we've got inventory laid down for years and years that we are distilling, 100% of the barley that we're growing. So based off of Angel's share and whatnot, we've been able to figure out that we're looking at about 2,500 cases a year for the wool. And it's not something necessarily that we can scale up with this expression, but if we wanted to maybe buy barley and think about expanding, maybe into some other expressions or something down the line, that's of course a possibility. But right now, Bren, the estate cask bottling is all estate grown barley and pretty limited.
Can you see selling it in France at some point?
Yeah, I hope so. as an American, one of the reasons that I really set out on this quest of trying to bring in some whiskeys from non-traditional countries, and I started this a long time ago before people were really talking about it, and I'm very glad that other companies have done this, because my energy shifted towards Bren once I found that, and I'm glad that there's so many out there, but for me it was really important that I brought this to the States first. I'm an American, I'm a New Yorker, and I thought it was a little rude when I would travel abroad and I would see all of these amazing whiskeys that I knew we weren't going to get in the States. It's not rude, but there was definitely a jealousy factor. So I said, if I am able to do this, I would like to bring it to the States first. And I would love one day to sell some to France, and I would love to sell some to the UK, but first I need to take care of America.
You'll find my tasting notes for Bren at WhiskeyCast.com, and in April's episode of WhiskeyCast Virtual Tastings, our tasting panel reviewed it as well. There are links to the Bren and Sia websites at WhiskeyCast.com, and that's this week's WhiskeyCast In-Depth, brought to you by Woodford Reserve. Discover Woodford Reserve Double Oaked, uniquely matured in two separate new white oak barrels, the second deeply toasted and lightly charred for a more complex dimensional flavor. Find out more at WoodfordReserve.com. Be double sure. Drink responsibly. Woodford Reserve Double Oaked, Kentucky Straight Bourbon Whiskey, 45.2% alcohol by volume, Woodford Reserve Distillery, Versailles, Kentucky. Let's start off the What I'm Tasting This Week department with Karen's Sia Blended Scotch. It's bottled at 43% ABV. The nose is a combination of tropical fruits and spices with mango, grapefruit, ginger, mild cinnamon, and a light sweet smokiness. That smokiness carries over onto the palate along with honey, creme brulee, mild cinnamon, grapefruit, mango, and just a hint of orange peel. The finish has notes of toffee, ginger, cinnamon, and grapefruit. And I was very impressed. I'm scoring Sia a 91. I wanted to compare it, though, to a couple of other blended scotches with a lot of history. Black and White is one of those classic scotch brands that would never be considered trendy, but has managed to endure the test of time. It's bottled at 40% ABV. The nose is spicy and warm with pepper, ginger, honey, vanilla, and hints of dark chocolate and wood smoke. The taste is spicy and peppery with additional notes of ginger, orange peel, and brown sugar that add balance, but turns fruity leading into the finish too, with hints of mango, and that finish is fruity, mouthwatering, and long. There's good balance and complexity here. I'm scoring Black and White a 90. Black and White was originally created by James Buchanan, who also created the Buchanan's blends. Both are now owned by Diageo. Buchanan's Red Seal is primarily available in the Latin American market, though you may find it almost anywhere these days. It's bottled at 43% ABV. The nose is smooth and clean, with a hint of smoke, roasted almonds, and a hint of honey. The taste is smooth with a nice spiciness, notes of cinnamon, honey, and hints of lemon and black tea. The finish is smooth, lingering, and spicy. I'm scoring Buchanan's Red Seal an 88. These tasting notes are available at WhiskeyCast.com, where you can search through my notes for almost 1,000 different whiskeys. To be exact, there are 999 on the website as of today. The next one I post will be number 1,000. You'll also find WhiskeyCast HD and WhiskeyCast Virtual Tastings episodes at the website, too, along with the calendar of events, the latest whiskey news, and a searchable archive of past episodes. The address is WhiskeyCast.com. And my email address for questions and suggestions is comments@WhiskeyCast.com.
WhiskeyCast. Proudly brought to you by Redbreast. The definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Join the stillhouse at singlepotstill.com and receive an exclusive whiskey tasting journal.
WhiskeyCast is a production of Cask Strength Media, copyright 2013, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.